U.S. soldiers used for these experiments, there were thousands more who paid the price for the projects approved by the American government, people in Korea and elsewhere who received the final product which resulted from these experiments. The most voiceless victims of the CIA's biological warfare were these non-Americans whose suffering didn't seem to be an area of concern, as they were citizens of the so-called enemy countries. You see, the most dangerous brainwashing method is not that which was done using LSD and other drugs and terror techniques, but the media propaganda that dictates to people every single day which lives should matter and which ones are simply all the expendables. Perhaps it's time for us to unplug ourselves from all the noise from the screens and give our minds time to process what is reality and what is a creation of cyberspace. Be able to discern the real from the created is the test of the day. And depending on how well we score, it can help determine if we can free our minds or simply behave like a puppet on a string, giving in to the whims and directions of others on the web. Well, with that, it brings us to the end of this week's show, and we hope you will be joining us for our next Hidden Files. Until next time, I'm Marzia Hashemi for Hidden Files.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. In the limelight.
Europe is facing a polycrisis these days, as experts say, between contradictory energy policies, the Ukraine war, and political disarray, the EU appears on a mission to harm itself. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Middle East Eye noted, better late than never. The old motto states, this should be the conclusion after reading the recent Economist's latest lead article on how Europe is frozen out. The magazine's concern is that the continent faces an enduring crisis of energy and geopolitics that will weaken it and threaten its global position, while the brutal economic squeeze will pose a test of Europe's resilience in 2023 and beyond. This perspective was already evident months ago, but only with an incoming freezing winter is it making its way to one of the flagships of Western mainstream media. The magazine also emphasizes the fear that the recasting of the global energy system, American economic populism, and geopolitical rifts threaten the long-run competitiveness of the European Union and non-members, including Britain, noting it is not just the continent's prosperity that is at risk, the health of the transatlantic alliance is too. Effectively, the high price that the U.S. charges Europe for its liquefied natural gas, LNG supplies, the Federal Reserve's policies on interest rates that are propping up the dollar, and the Biden administration's $369 billion package of green subsidies under the auspices of the Inflation Reduction Act have all heightened tensions between the two shores of the Atlantic. In such conditions, the European economy's competitiveness risks being compromised. The energy crisis remains Europe's top priority. The latest OECD economic outlook notes that the share of members' GDP spent on end-use energy is almost 18%, double what it was in 2020. The outlook also warns of a substantial risk that gas reserves in Europe will be smaller next winter than this one. According to the Economist's own modeling, in a normal winter, a 10% rise in real energy prices is associated with a 0.6% increase in debt. Hence, the energy crunch this year could cause over 100,000 extra deaths of elderly people across Europe. Europe has been able to fill its gas stores for this coming winter almost to full capacity, but this target has been accomplished through an increase of more than 40% in imports of Russian LNG between January and October, compared with the same period last year. It is difficult to find a word better than tragi-economic to describe such a situation. This data exemplifies both EU foolishness and the dysfunction of its institutions. Geopolitical reasons have pushed Europe to diversify its energy supplies away from Russian gas in order to avoid relying on Russia. EU decision makers should now explain the logic behind giving up the cheapest supply option, pipe-delivered gas, to opt for the most expensive one, seaborne-delivered LNG from the same supplier. If the situation compels Europe to continue relying on Russian gas, why pick the most expensive option? The situation is so absurd that it leads people to ask, between the EU and Russia, who is really sanctioning whom? The EU's apparent drive towards self-harm could get a further boost from the price cap on Russian oil that Brussels is expected to adopt. The aim is to reduce Russia's revenues, but the situation could turn against Europe. No one really knows the possible impacts of such a measure on oil supply and price. The Biden administration has apparently lobbied the EU to relax its sanctions policy because further measures could completely disrupt oil markets and intensify the energy crunch. This marks a further tragicomic situation. The U.S., which with regards to some countries, has claimed universal justification by applying its secondary sanctions against everybody, including EU members, is now pressuring the EU to avoid walking the same path over Ukraine. As a consequence, while transatlantic political relations have been reinvigorated by a strong cohesive position against Russia, economic relations could come under severe stress if the burden sharing on the Ukraine-Russia crisis economic cost continues to be unequal. This is a message that French President Emmanuel Macron delivered during his state visit to Washington. German Chancellor Olaf Scholz has already conveyed a far more assertive message to Washington by visiting Beijing accompanied by top businessmen. Regardless of U.S. pressure and even contrary to the Brussels bureaucracy's own recommendations, Germany has no intention to decouple from China, seeming far more aware that the U.S. that, in words of its own chancellor, new centers of powers are emerging in a multipolar world, and we aim to establish and expand partnerships with all of them. In other words, Scholz's message to Biden is the following. If I have felt compelled to painfully sever my energy relationship with Russia due to the war in Ukraine, do not think for a moment that I will feel compelled to do the same for my trade relationship with China. U.S. economic policies and the energy crunch are damaging European economies to the point that even the economies recognizes that the continent is at risk of mass deindustrialization. Brussels decision makers are apparently unaware that they are running towards a cliff. The Biden administration might show more wisdom and common sense. After all, what advantage would the U.S. get in reinforcing the transatlantic bond if the price could ultimately be the economic destruction of the EU in the Eurasian continent? It is already evident that in the Russia-Ukraine conflict, Europe is the biggest external loser. But its anxieties do not end there. According to the European Central Bank's estimates, from now up until 2030, the EU should spend more than 5 trillion euros, 5 trillion euros, to move ahead with its green transition, diversify energy supplies, bridge the digital gap, and reach the NATO military expenditure target of 2% GDP. Roughly equivalent to the cost of post-COVID EU recovery plan every year, until the end of the decade. It is difficult to imagine how Europe will be able to accomplish such a tremendous task in an era of polycrisis, described by former U.S. Treasury Secretary Larry Summers as the most complex, disparate, and cross-cutting set of challenges they have faced in four decades. It is even more difficult to imagine considering the current trio leading the EU. The presidents of the European Council and European Commission are apparently not on speaking terms after an April 2021 protocol arrangement placed the first on an armchair and the second on a sofa, while the third, the EU foreign policy chief, cultivate sophisticated visions of international politics, such as Europe is a garden and most of the rest of the world is a jungle. Indeed, Europe's drive for self-harm is running at full speed.
the wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Tehran has slammed Washington's move to push a draft resolution aimed to remove Iran from the UN's Commission on the Status of Women. Iran's foreign ministry says any misuse of the internal developments in Iran to exert political pressure on the country is condemned and unacceptable. Iran has just started a four-year term on the body after a recent voting session by the UN Economic and Social Council. Tehran has repeatedly warned that some Western countries are exploiting human rights for their own political ends. In recent weeks, rioters went on the rampage across the country, brutally attacking security officers and causing massive damage to public property as Western powers, especially the United States, provided support. The European Union and some Western countries have imposed sanctions on Iran over its approach toward the riots. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani said that the U.S. and certain European countries are behind the political and illegal draft resolution and that they are seeking to exert pressure on independent countries to pass it. He said the U.S. move is an action against the free vote of countries in international organizations and structures and questions the legality of such mechanisms in international bodies. He added, there are member countries of the UN Security Council or the Human Rights Council and Human Rights Assemblies that committed countless crimes against governments and independent nations throughout their history and now use human rights tools to exert pressure. Iran has lashed out at Western officials for cheering rioters in independent states while suppressing peaceful protesters in their own countries. Iran's foreign ministry says countries that have coups, conspiracies, interventions and devastating wars with millions of deaths in their history are now pretending to be defenders of human rights in other countries. The best example would be Western countries' hypocritical behavior vis-a-vis protests in Iran and their own states. Western officials say the protests in Britain, Germany, France, Canada, and Australia are bad and deserve severe confrontation, but riots in their targeted countries are good and deserve support. The riots in Iran began after the death of a young woman named Mahsa Amini in September. She collapsed at a police station in Tehran and later died at a hospital. Since then, the issue of women's rights suddenly caught the imagination of the world. The self-proclaimed human rights champions in the West who turn a blind eye to gross human rights abuses in the US and Europe are accusing Iranian authorities of killing the woman, even though all evidence, including the forensic report, scoffs at those claims. The Islamic Republic has strongly censured several countries for provoking riots in the country through their spy agencies and propaganda apparatus. London, in particular, hosts several anti-Iranian networks, including Iran International, Manoto, and BBC Persian. The U.S. is pushing for the removal of Iran from the UN Commission on the Status of Women following trumped-up claims by foreign media that attributed the killing of women to the Iranian government during the recent unrest in the country. They claim that they are acting in defense of women's rights, but they are in fact violating those rights and preventing women from raising their issues through pushing for the removal of Iran from the UN Commission. The 54-member UN Economic and Social Council is expected to vote on December 14th whether to oust Iran from the commission or not. U.S. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin has said the country is building a more lethal force posture in the Indo-Pacific as part of efforts to make sure China doesn't dominate the region the way it intends to. Addressing the Reagan National Defense Forum, Austin said China is the only country with both the will and increasingly the power to reshape its region and the international order. He added that Washington will not let that happen. The Pentagon chief added that the next few years will set the terms of the U.S. competition with the People's Republic of China, saying Beijing will shape the future of security in Europe. Referring to the modernization of the country's military force, he said that the U.S. is aligning its budget as never before to China challenge.
We're aligning our budget as never before to the China challenge. We're making the department's largest investment ever in R&D and forging stronger capabilities. And we're modernizing training and equipping the U.S. military contingencies in the Indo-Pacific.
He went on to say one of the meanings of deterrence is sea power, announcing that the Pentagon is investing in the new construction of 9 battle force ships and Columbia-class ballistic missile submarines. Last month, one of Washington's Ford-class nuclear-powered carriers made its first transit to Europe. Austin also noted that the Pentagon is concerned about Russia and remains committed to arming Ukraine while avoiding escalating that conflict into a U.S. war with Moscow. However, he said between the two nuclear power threats, China remains the greater risk. The Pentagon has also unveiled B-21 Raider, its first new strategic bomber in more than 30 years.
The B-21 Raider is the first strategic bomber in more than 3 decades. It is a testament to America's enduring advantages in ingenuity and innovation, and it's proof of the department's long-term commitment to building advanced capabilities that will fortify America's ability to deter aggression today and into the future.
The nuclear-capable Batwing plane is being designed to best the quickly growing cyber, space, and nuclear capabilities of Beijing. The bomber is part of a major nuclear triad overhaul underway that the Congressional Budget Office has estimated will cost $1.2 trillion through 2046. It includes the Raider serving as the backbone of the future airleg of the triad, but it also requires modernizing the nation's Silo-launched nuclear intercontinental ballistic missiles and its nuclear submarine fleet. The comments by Austin amount to a new warning shot to President Xi Jinping, even as the U.S. looks to establish what it calls guardrails and keep tension with China from spiraling out of control. The Pentagon released its annual report last week on China, which said the Asian nation has doubled its number of nuclear warheads in a fraction of time the U.S. expected it to. China could have roughly 1,500 nuclear warheads by 2038, which are far less than what the United States possesses right now. The U.S. maintained 5,550 nuclear warheads as of December 1st of this year. But U.S. military officials keep claiming that China will soon surpass Russia as the top nuclear threat to the United States, warning that the two nuclear powers have no mechanisms to avoid miscommunication. China has reportedly accelerated the expansion of its nuclear arsenal due to a change in the country's assessment of the threat posed by the U.S. The U.S. Defense Department has the largest discretionary budget of all the federal agencies, and it may receive up to $847 billion in the 2023 budget if Congress passes the current funding bill before this legislative session ends. In a recent meeting with its Chinese counterpart, Austin said he made it clear that the United States will continue to fly, sail, and operate wherever international law allows. On the other hand, China's defense minister said Taiwan is at the center of the country's core interests and is a red line the U.S. should not cross. He added that the issue has nothing to do with external forces and is for Chinese people to decide. Washington and Beijing have held war games and traded jabs since a visit to Taiwan by the U.S. House Speaker in August. China claims Taiwan as part of its territory. It has harshly criticized Washington's ties with Taipei as interference in its internal affairs. The two Western and Eastern powerhouses currently disagree on just about every major issue, from human rights, Taiwan, the Ukraine war, North Korea, and the transfer of technology to the shape and naming of the map. Thank you.
protesters in the Persian Gulf island of Bahrain. They're chanting death to Israel. Their reason, the Israeli President Isaac Herzog was visiting the Persian Gulf island, the first Israeli president visiting Bahrain. The day before, protesters carried signs with Herzog's image that said criminal and you are not welcome in Bahrain. Opposition activists launched a campaign on social media speaking out against normalization with Israel. But why was Herzog visiting Bahrain in the first place? And why was there such opposition to his visit? As for the reason of his visit, it was at the invitation of King Hamad bin Isa al-Khalifa. It is reported that he will meet with members of the local Jewish community and senior government officials. He will also lead a group of Israeli business people to meet with the Bahraini Economic Development Board. But these things could be done by other officials from Israel. It wouldn't need the Israeli president to make a trip to Bahrain for that, unless there are other reasons for the visit. For starters, Israel needs to maintain a high-profile presence when it comes to its relationship with Persian Gulf Arab leaders. This is crucial for Israel as part of the so-called normalization process. Israel normalized ties with the UAE and Bahrain in 2020 as part of the U.S.-brokered Abraham Accords. The agreement paved the way for the normalization with Morocco months later. But the U.S.-led process has not taken off quite the way the U.S. and Israel intended to. For although the leaders of Israel and UAE and Bahrain may have gotten closer, the population of these Arab countries have displayed anger and animosity towards Israel, as was evident in the World Cup in Qatar. The reason for this amount of anger toward Israel is very clear. Palestine and Palestinians.
What is this?
Israel Channel. You don't like us?
You are not welcome here. There is only Palestine.
Israel's continued repression and violation of Palestinian rights throughout the decades has been met with some Arab leaders engaging with Israel through the so-called Abraham Accords. For their citizens, this is unacceptable and a betrayal of the Palestinian cause. It appears that the Abraham Accords have become a substitute for improving the lives of Palestinians. Bahrain has been experiencing an uprising since the beginning of 2011, although the island itself has seen government opposition due to the marginalization of the Shia population itself. Since the uprising, which has continued until this day, the government has been relentless in violating the rights on a vast number of issues. Torture, illegal detentions, sham trials, and death sentences are just some of the examples of the repression of the Bahrainis. Yet despite these human rights violations, the West, in particular the U.S. and its allies, have turned a blind eye to these violations, just like they have done when it comes to Saudi Arabia. Bahrain saw the so-called normalization as a way of strengthening its close relations with the U.S. and its position in Washington, especially among the pro-Israel community, in order to bolster American support for Bahrain and deflect criticism of the kingdom's human rights record. Bahrain also hosts the U.S. Navy's Fifth Fleet and U.S. Naval Forces Central Command. As such, it is well aware that the rights of Bahrainis is being violated, yet the U.S. chooses to do nothing about it. Israel is clearly the biggest beneficiary of the Abraham Accords. Israel's military is deepening its cooperation with the militaries of Bahrain and the UAE under the umbrella of the U.S. This was pretty evident when all four held their first naval exercise last November in the Red Sea. This all comes down to Israel further undercutting regional support for the Palestinians. Let's not forget, an American official who helped broker the Abraham Accords admitted that their entire aim was to isolate the Palestinians, to put them on, quote, an island. He said the plan was that if we get everybody around the Palestinians to recognize Israel, then where does that leave the Palestinians? They will have to come because they are on an island. 2 years after the Abraham Accords were signed, this is what it has brought Palestinians. Death, execution style.
The U.S. president said on Thursday that he would be willing to speak to Vladimir Putin if he truly wants to end the war.
That was the first time he had expressed willingness to speak with the Russian leader since the beginning of the war in February, around which time he said that he will not be speaking with Putin. He made his comments as he was delivering a speech at a joint White House news conference with French President Emmanuel Macron. Here's what he said about the war in Ukraine and the unrealistic conditions under which he would speak to Putin.
Look, there's one way for this war to end, the rational way. Putin to pull out of Ukraine, number one. But it appears he's not going to do that. But the fact of the matter is, I have no immediate plans to contact Mr. Putin. Mr. Putin is, I choose my words very carefully. I'm prepared to speak with Mr. Putin if, in fact, there is an interest in him deciding he's looking for a way to end the war. He hasn't done that yet.
Biden further added, if that's the case, in consultation with my French and my NATO friends, I'll be happy to sit down with Putin to see what he has in mind, as he and Macron vowed long-term support for Ukraine. The Kremlin took note of Biden's comments and responded through its spokesman, Dmitry Peskov. He said that Putin remains open to negotiations, but he is not going to pull his troops out of Ukraine. Peskov emphasized another unrealistic condition that Biden had set for talking with Putin. That would be the West's refusal to recognize the quote-unquote new territories that Russia annexed during the controversial September referendums. All that said, Peskov was not dismissive of the potentiality of talks between the two superpowers. While outlining Russia's conditions for the talks, he said, President Putin has been, is, and remains open for contacts for negotiations. Of course, the most preferable way to achieve our interests is through peaceful diplomatic means. While it is difficult to assess both parties' actual willingness to talk, what is objectively true is the fact that President Biden had not expressed any willingness to sit down with Putin, with or without the unrealistic conditions he set. Could it be that the very difficult winter ahead of Ukraine and the rest of Europe is making the West reconsider negotiating with Putin? While President Biden was playing fast and loose with the idea of holding peace talks and simultaneously setting unrealistic prerequisites for it, President Macron expressed a more dovish tone by simply saying, "I will continue to talk to President Putin," as he called for efforts, quote, "to prevent escalation and to achieve concrete results." Macron also stated that Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has also shown, quote-unquote, real willingness to pursue peace. Elsewhere in Europe, German Chancellor Olaf Scholz spoke with President Putin on the phone and urged the Russian leader to find a diplomatic solution to the war as soon as possible. Scholz also called for the Russian troops to fully withdraw from Ukraine, an unlikely scenario to unfold. Putin told Scholz on the phone that Germany and the entire Western Bloc's approach towards Ukraine was destructive, as he called on Scholz to rethink his approach. It is unclear whether or not Germany, France, or the U.S. would initiate peace talks with Russia, but it seems that, at the very least, they are leaving the option on the table, despite some major disagreements between the two sides on the prerequisites for the talks. Something that was expected to hurt the potentiality of peace talks, but doesn't seem to now, is the price cap that was going to be imposed on Russian oil by the G7, EU, and Australia. They have, in fact, imposed the price cap at $60 per Russian crude oil barrel, but the amount is actually well above what Russian oil is trading for right now. This means that Russian oil will still flow, and that the West has not been able to find an alternative source to Russian oil, as Russia is still the major oil provider for the countries setting the price cap. The chair of Russian Lower House's Foreign Affairs Committee, Leonid Slutsky, believes that the price cap will only end up jeopardizing EU's energy security as the world waits to see how Russia will react to the move.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is Back to Reality. Back to Reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, everyone. Dear sisters and brothers from all around the world, I hope you're doing well. This is a new episode of Back to Reality, and I'm very happy to be here as your host. Actually, you're listening to Asma. And then here with me, I have two very dear guests, Sister Bita and Sister Zainab. Welcome.
Assalamu alaikum. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for being here.
Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam.
Thank you for having me here with you. That's my pleasure to be here with your listeners.
Thank you for being here. Thank you. Thank you, both of you, for coming. And this is actually a pleasure for me to be here with you. And it's such an enjoyable session with you too. Well, now before we start, just give us a very brief introduction about your background.
Actually, I'm Bita, and I'm studying medicine at one of the universities of Tehran.
Yeah.
And I'm really interested in that sort of topics that we were discussing in our radio, and that's my pleasure again that I'm here with you.
I am from Kashmir, the Indian administrated Kashmir, and I am done with master's in linguistics. I am studying in seminary school right now, and I have been working as TV anchor from past 8 years.
So, very nice. It's a pleasure to have you in here. Well, thank as you. For today, we are going to discuss something that might sound very much depressing. But it is the truth. There is no way to ignore death, because one day, or I don't know, 1 hour, there would be this world without me. Death is something pretty much actual, and there is no way to ignore it. We all are going to face it one day. It might sound depressing, but I guess to some points it would be a sign of hope as well. Now, can you relate to the hope part?
Yeah, of course. You know,
Sister Bita can.
Everyone, I start from my own experience. Yeah. As you know, in our ID cards, there is a part for your death, which, you know, there are days, the reason of your death, and so on. Whenever I actually open my ID card and I open that page of my death, I have a special feeling. You know, you cannot imagine what feeling is, but it is so special that you are seeing the page that will someday will be filled with the, you know, identification and the information of your death. And that is always touching for me. I don't know why. And but this feeling
it's
is not that much
depressing. And sad.
Yeah, it's not always the absolute depression when I see that page. You know,
really?
It's like, okay, I'm not dead yet, and this is the hope that you were talking about, I think. You know, and I think one blessing that we all have, the human being has, is that we don't know the date of our death. And this is a blessing, of course it is, because I think if every single one of us knew the date of her or his death, it would be disastrous, you know? You didn't have any hope.
Yeah, you see, there were some movies, I don't know if you have watched or not, but there are plenty of them, I guess.
Yeah, exactly.
In which there is a woman, or whatever, the hero of the movie or the hero of the book, the novel, is getting some special intuitions, some special blessing, or let me say just a curse, has been given to them. And then they suddenly can understand the date of death of other people. And then there comes a day when they understand the date of their own death. That's actually a disaster. That's very difficult to bear. And now I would like to hear Sister Zainab's idea about that, which is actually telling me with her face, but now you cannot see it. So now she's so sad. Okay.
Well, I'm so scared. Well,
now, Sister, why death is so scary?
To some, it's scary. I don't have firm faith.
To most, I guess it's scary.
Sister Bita said that I have a special feeling. I love, like, she loves to get the certificate of death. But she said, I love to see that page filled. She loves to get the certificate. But I have always, like, worked, because I am studying. I don't want to get the certificate. I want to work after getting the certificate. So what would I do after getting the certificate? First of all, I won't get it into my hands, so I'll be done, I'll be over.
Yeah.
It's scary because most of us think it's the end.
Yeah, that's very true.
We in India or the Urdu language use the word intikal for death, which means transfer.
That is more accurate.
Yeah, which is more accurate for death. Yeah. It's not the end.
It's the precise thing that happens.
Exactly. But no one believes that it's not the end. Those who very firmly believe that I'm gone, that means I am gone. And there's going to be no me after me. There's no transfer or I don't know. They don't have very firm
now,
belief in that.
Your sentence,
that's what makes it scary.
Just what you said. There is no me. Then after this, let's keep it there, go for a short break, and we'll be back with the rest of the topic. So thank you, dear listeners.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
Welcome back. Well, we are discussing death in Back to Reality, and we have got some ideas in here. Well, death is depressing. Death is very much awkward. I guess because we do not have any idea about what's going on in the next step.
Yes, because maybe we are less literate towards that thing, that there is a world after this world that is going to be a transfer happening. I remember a day in my seminary school, our teacher told us that today we're going to talk about death, and everyone was, teacher, please change the topic, we don't want to talk about it.
Yeah.
She was like, after this session, I promise you, you will love death. So
how
you won't
come?
You won't be scared anymore. Yeah. Then people say like, well, then we got to the concept that it's a transfer. All right. Mm-hmm. So We are not aware of this transfer. It's a transfer into another world. Your soul lives. It's just your body that dies. So again, the girls in the class were like, because women are so much attached to their body.
Yeah.
So they're like, oh, we still are scared.
Exactly.
Yeah, I think, you know, only knowing about the afterlife is not enough, you know, to not have the fear of death.
Of course.
I think the most important part is the connection you have with this world. You have to lower this connection. You know what I'm telling you? For example,
attachment.
Yeah, exactly. Attachment is a better and nicer word. You know, you are that much attached to whatever you have in this world.
Exactly.
Money. Yeah. I don't know. Success. Opportunity. Job.
Job.
Whatever.
Yeah.
You know, this materialistic
family.
Love.
Family.
Family.
Yeah, even family, which is materialistic even in some points. And these all will make you somehow over-connected to this world.
Yeah.
And this is a problem, I think, that we are frightened from death.
Yeah, sister, I do believe in that, you know. Sometimes I think if I was a person living on a far-fetched island, far away from people, not doing anything, and just was, you know, enjoying nature and then living a happy life all alone with the, you know, trees and the seas and whatever, I would have maybe felt scared of death even lesser than right now. Because at that time, then I would have had no attachment to this world, you know?
Mm-hmm.
The more you grow in having attachment, the more your list of attachments is growing, the more scared you're going to be. Because even when I sleep at night, I would say, okay, I have this that must be done. I have that must be done. I have plenty much of responsibilities. I have a family to feed. I have whatever. And a lot of things, you know, the list is increasing as you just count. Then you come to think, okay, what if I die?
Yeah.
You know, when you become sick, that moment comes
exactly.
to you.
Exactly. And everything seems somehow numb and
exactly.
meaningless.
Yeah.
And I hate that feeling. But I think this is a need of everyday life.
Exactly.
You have to experience that feeling of being numb, being, I don't know, meaningless about everything.
Yeah.
To actually go for finding a meaning. You know what I'm telling you? And this, actually, I think this death content will motivate you to do this.
Yeah.
And this is a motivation at the same time that is so scary. And we have to appreciate it, I think.
Yeah,
you know,
very
the content
much.
Of death and not knowing that when you will die is so important, you know. And I think another disaster that will happen is, like, for example, if you know some other people dates of death, what would you do? Would you try to save that person? Or not?
Well, if it's something that has been, you know, it's fatal. There's no way to control it. I can never control.
If you had
a thing that's been written. Well, if I had the ability to control it, I would have, you know, because in the movies that we talked already about, sometimes you can just prevent that person to go to that travel in order not to, you know, have an accident. And or you can prevent someone from going somewhere that, I don't know, some burning thing is going to happen. Things like this, yes, but I don't think you can fight death.
Yeah, exactly.
This is the truth. This is the fatal truth that
and
you cannot fight death.
Going under this burden of responsibility to avoid death is something that is useless.
Yeah, it's useless. Now, in this part, I would love to ask Sister Zainab about the concept of death. But before that, let's go for a short break and we'll be back. Thank you, dear listeners. Welcome back, dear listeners. You are listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Back to Reality in here. Asma is your host and our dear guests, Sister Zainab and Sister Bita. We are discussing something interesting, I guess. Let's call it interesting because death is not depressing as we grow older, you know? When I was younger, maybe death was something very much scary because I did not have this much of knowledge about the other world. And I haven't seen so much of people dying in front of me, you know? I don't know if it happened to you or not, but when we are younger, when we are actually children, it seems that the world are less prone to death. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You hear less of people dying around you. But as you get older, you send so much of people into the other world that you, even yourself, would love to go there. You know what I mean?
Well, yes, as I was a child, I was very, very scared. I even now I'm very scared because when I'm working in the kitchen, even now, so we have this television on always. And in the afternoon, I think every day this verse would get recited, which says every soul has to taste death.
Yeah,
I get shivered literally because I agree with Sister Bita. Attachment to this world because of the attachments to your family,
exactly.
Because of the attachment to your...
See, that's the difference between a mother and two not mother. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
We are not
mothers yet.
Exactly.
I am always concerned, like, if I scare us right now, it's not because, like, I don't believe that there's no other world. I'm very much concerned about who's going to take care of my children.
Yeah,
and that's,
that
again, something missing in my faith. That is, I should know, like, my husband keeps on repeating this to me thousands of times, who tells me that you should know that if you're not there, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is there.
Exactly. He's
because
the
there
owner.
Have been so many people out there.
Yeah.
Like, if you help them, they don't need your help, but you still are, you know, you consistent that I have to help this person. I have to help. I have to be there.
Yeah.
I have to be there. I am that kind of person. But then that help ends up in a very bad way. It's not needed. And I still force myself. I have to do this. I have to do this. Just because this concept is not clear. If you're not there, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is there.
Exactly.
And I don't know. There was a story which said that, like, there was an interview with the angel of death. He was asked, was there a time you were happy or was there a time you were scared while taking the soul from someone's body? And he replies, like, there was a shoemaker who was polishing the shoes and making, binding the shoes together. And he told the person it would last for thousands of years. And I took his life and he could not save his own life and he was guaranteeing the shoe. So I was like laughing at that time. But the moment there was a mother giving delivery to a child, I had to take the life of that mother.
Yeah,
I was really trembling to do that because I was concerned about the kid. There was another moment in my life, I had to take the life of a very, very shining personality, was a very great scholar towards the end of his life, and I had to take out the soul, and I was having very strong, very different kind of feeling. And then I was told that this soul that you took at the end was the same child
Very nice.
You felt trembled for because there's Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala who's going to take care.
Yeah, that's really nice. If you think about the other world and getting united with your loved one in there and having a life which is going to be eternal, then death is not going to sound as bitter as it sounds when you do not think about it properly. So that's it. I wish you have a good time. Thank you for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again.
Ya Allah,
Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again. Let us see daylight again, once again.
In the limelight. Recently, Republicans have taken control of the U.S. House of Representatives in the midterm elections. As the U.S. Senate remains in Democratic control, the two parties should work together to continue funding Ukraine's conflict with Russia, which will enter a new phase as the cold season begins. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The website Politico has more for us. The US military may run out of money for the Ukraine conflict, as Republicans are planning to cut Pentagon appropriations for Ukraine. Citing U.S. Department of Defense internal documents and officials familiar with the matter, Politico reported on Saturday, 3rd of December, that Congress has until 16th of December to pass a full-year defense stopgap bill, known as a continuing resolution, or a CR, as Republicans and Democrats debate appropriations. The report said the resolution is supposed to cut Pentagon funding by $29 billion compared to what the Biden administration requested for the fiscal year 2023. This means that the Pentagon would have to abandon certain projects, including unchecked military aid to Kiev, to fund its war with Russia. Pentagon's chief financial officer, Michael McCord, reportedly said recently that the U.S. would have problems transporting new munitions to Ukraine, as the funds marked by Kiev would run out in spring. Meanwhile, U.S. House Armed Services Chair Adam Smith, on Saturday, 3rd of December, rejected Republican arguments that there isn't enough oversight of American military assistance to Ukraine. The Washington State Democrat said the GOP claimed that tens of billions of dollars in Ukraine aid isn't overseen properly makes me a little crazy. He also claimed that those assertions are part of a Russian disinformation campaign. According to an NBC News report, U.S. Congress has allocated a total of $65 billion in funding for Kiev since Russia began its special operation in Ukraine last February. The U.S. State Department, however, said recently that the Biden administration's total commitment to Kiev was nearly $19.7 billion. U.S. President Joe Biden has said he expects American aid to Ukraine will continue without interruption, despite opposition by Republicans, who are expected to use their new majority in the House of Representatives to monitor the flow of aid to Ukraine. Russia has repeatedly warned that supplying Kiev with more and more weapons will only exacerbate the conflict, which is now in its ninth month. Recently, Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov said continuously flooding Ukraine with weapons will only drag the conflict out and make it more painful for the Ukrainian side. But it will not change our goals and the end result. Dmitry Peskov insisted that the United States was in reality engaged in the Ukraine conflict. He said, the U.S. de facto has become deeply involved. NBC News has also covered the same story. The United States will soon be unable to provide Ukraine with certain types of ammunition that are essential to Kiev's battle against Russia's special operation, as supplies are being used up faster than they can be replaced. Washington has become by far the largest supplier of arms and ammunition to Ukraine since Russia launched its special operation last February, with more than $16.8 billion in military assistance provided since that date. But Mark Kansian of the Center for Strategic and International Studies wrote in a recent analysis, U.S. stockpiles of some equipment are reaching the minimum levels needed for war plans and training, and restocking to pre-operation levels could take years. A U.S. military official acknowledged on condition of anonymity, Washington is learning lessons from the conflict about ammunition needs in a great power war, which are far greater than expected. American defense firms were forced to drastically reduce production in the 1990s as the United States slashed defense spending following the collapse of the former Soviet Union, and their number fell dramatically from dozens to single digits. Now the U.S. government must convinced the industry to reopen assembly lines and relaunch production of items such as Stinger anti-craft missiles, which have not been made since 2020. Some U.S.-provided equipment has become emblematic of the war in Ukraine, such as Javelin anti-tank weapons that were widely used by Kiev forces to blunt the Russian advance on the Ukrainian capital, and the HIMARS, a precision rocket system now playing a key role in counter-operations against Moscow's troops in the east and south of Ukraine. But U.S. stocks of ammunition for HIMARS, which fires GPS-guided rockets known as GMLRS, with a range of more than 80 kilometers, are dwindling. Mark Kansian said, if the United States sent one-third of that inventory to Ukraine, as has been the case with Javelin and Stinger missiles, Ukraine would receive 8,000 to 10,000 rockets. He said that inventory would likely last several months, but when the inventory is exhausted, there are no alternatives. Production is about 5,000 a year, although the United States is working to increase that amount, and money has recently been allocated for that purpose. It will take years. He added, the older equipment could help fill the gap. The U.S. government ordered $350 million worth of the missiles in May, but it will take several years before stockpiles are replenished. According to official Pentagon statistics, the United States has also supplied more than 800,000 NATO standard 155mm artillery shells to Kiev, three-quarters of the total amount delivered by all Western countries. The English website of Al Jazeera has also covered the same story. The U.S. midterm elections have exposed the deep divisions within the Republican Party over just how to support Ukraine financially and militarily. J.D. Vance, the Republican senator-elect from Ohio and a loyal ally of former President Donald Trump, has insisted that Congress has got to stop the money spigot to Ukraine eventually. The far-right conspiracy theorist Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene, who won re-election in Georgia, declared in a campaign rally before the midterm elections that, under Republicans, not another penny will go to Ukraine. Since the vote, She has introduced a resolution in Congress calling for an audit of U.S. spending on the war in Ukraine. Kevin McCarthy.